most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It is Monday, October 8th, Columbus Day. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end marijuana prohibition in America. Take a moment to join us at norml.org, make a donation, or become an official member of Normal today. You also have a chance to interact with Normal if you're in Los Angeles this week. The Normal Annual Conference starts this Friday. It goes from Friday until Saturday. Saturday is also the High Times Normal Stony Awards. Very, very good stuff happening in Los Angeles this week. More information about the 2007 conference is available on Normal's website. We have a direct link at normalaudiostash.com. As I am aware, you can still get a couple of those conference registrations. So if you'd like to attend, make sure you register today. In a warm-up for the 2007 conference, we have some audio from last year's Normal Conference in San Francisco. Today, we'll hear Jerry Mandel talk about the history of marijuana prohibition in America. We'll also hear from Marsha Rosenbaum, who will be speaking at this year's conference as well. Let's start with Jerry Mandel. He's introduced by California Normal's Dale Gerringer.
Thank you. Our next historian is Jerry Mandel, who is responsible for a number, deflating a number of myths out there. I don't know how many of you have heard about Marco Polo and the Assassins, but you should certainly read Jerry Mandel's deflation of that whole story. He's also worked with the old soldier's disease and some other things. Jerry, today we'll be talking about...
I find I already have only 5 minutes left. Okay, let's get you moving here. How many of you know when the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 was passed? Hands? Fine. Now that we have you into the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, the power punch behind the Marijuana Tax Act, the most menacing facts about marijuana. The reason that Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act so quickly, without dissent and without consideration, were four basic pieces of evidence. Two of them were historical myths. One of them was the assassin's tale of the old man of the mountains, actually leading Shiites from leading terrorists from the late 11th century to the 13th century, a Shiite sect in Iraq. But I don't want to make any analogies to current policy. Now, that was one of them. The second one was running amok on opium. Now, I had a choice when this speech was, when Dale asked me to do this talk. I said, well, I'm going to go back to 40 years ago when I wrote that last article on assassins and say, what have I learned in 40 years, if anything? But it got too difficult, and I decided to take the easiest argument, the easiest thing, which is running amok on opium or running amok on marijuana, and to see where this led me. So I went into my files. Here's what I found out about running amok on marijuana. First of all, at the Marijuana Tax Act hearings, Commissioner Anslinger leads off his testimony as follows. In 1090 AD, the Religious and Military Order, or Sect of the Assassins, was founded in Persia, and the numerous acts of cruelty of this sect were well known. This branch of the Shiites were called Hashishin, derived from hashish, or marijuana. In fact, the Arabic Hashishin, from that we have the English word assassin. Next paragraph. Natives of the Malay Peninsula have been known, while under the influence, to rush out and engage in violent and bloody deeds with complete disregard for their personal safety or the odds arrayed against them. To run amok in the Malay Peninsula is synonymous with being under the influence of this drug. Where does it come from? Where does this madness come from? So, from the Mandel files. Earliest reference, 1659. Here it is from a book by a Dutch explorer in the East Indies. I saw at Batavia the breast torn with red-hot tongs off a black Indian by the executioner, and after this he was broken on the wheel from below upwards. This was because the evil habit of eating opium, according to the godless custom of the Indians, he had become mad and raised the cry of amok, in which mad state he had slain five persons. This was the third amok crier whom I saw during that visit to Batavia, broken on the wheel for murder. Hey, something to worry about. Second mention by an explorer, early in the 18th century. Again, Malaya. When weary of their own life or illness, they seek death through the punishment and death of others. For this they swallow a lump of opium, which strengthens dedication, disturbs reason, and liberates spirits from restraint. With dagger in hand, they rush like raging tigers into the streets, bent on slaughtering whomever they meet, whether friend or foe, until they themselves are struck down by another person. This is a frequent sight in Java and the further Orient, called hamuk. The very sound of the word terrifies. Well, I found 10 people for about a century into the early 1800s who recount running amok on opium. The most popular repetition of the story by far involves two different stories combined. This will be my last quote on amok, I think, maybe. One of them is the Javanese, under an extraordinary dose of opium, become frantic as well as desperate, and not only stab the objects of their hate, but also sally forth to attack in like manner every person they meet, till it is necessary to destroy them. They shout as they run, amok, amok, which means kill, kill. And this is my favorite story of amok, from a French author, French explorer, Grand Pré, somewhere between 1790 and 1805. The natives of Malacca, eating a great quantity of opium, produces on them a furious drunkenness, too large a dose, a paroxysm of rage, from which death alone can relieve them. Armed with a poniard, which they call Christ, poniard I think is a knife sort of,
which leaves a wound at least 2 inches wide, the more terrible from being poisoned, to form an idea of the rage and fury with which this opium inspires them. See them in their combats on board pirate vessels, receive a lance through their bodies, and not being able to draw it out, take hold of it and plunge it further in to be able to get at their enemy and stab him with their krist, a species of ferocity that obliges ships in danger of falling in with them to provide themselves with lances that have a guard through the middle of the shaft by means of which they keep them off and suffer them to die on their own. Okay. So, the first mention of the Amok tale has to do with opium through and through. And it's sort of forgotten. Every generation or two, there's a critic that just tears the myth apart, but he's forgotten and things go on. And the Opium War comes along. How many of you know when the Opium War is? Opium War of 1840 and 41 is. Okay. Shortly after that, there's another revival of interest in it. And then it dies. The myth dies. But it gets resurrected because a new tale has entered the literature. The Assassin's Tale, that old story of the 1300s, gets repeated by de Sacy, a French explorer who accompanied Napoleon in Egypt. And he reports that hashish causes murder, causes assassinations. And almost overnight, the myth becomes not that opium causes running amok, but that cannabis causes running amok. It happens instantaneously. And then it gets repeated two or three times every few years and with a critic every 20 years. But another interesting thing happens to me, and that is that the myth gets repeated by Americans instead of British and instead of foreigners. It becomes an American myth. The British, mainly in India, have rejected opium causes running amok and then reject cannabis running amok. And I have, what is that? I have 60 articles from 1800 to 1930, and 40 of them are by Americans, and there's one sentence of criticism of the concept. Among the 16 articles by British writers, six of them are critics of the system. So the British have made a decision in the 1900s to do away with this thing, and Americans have gotten very interested in running amok on marijuana. And the concept lies there. It's a stillborn concept. And I'm just looking for two American quotes to sort of conclude this. And these are from the late 1920s. One is a Hearst correspondent. This is the way she deals with the muck. This is in the Los Angeles Examiner. The date is February 25th, 1927, and the author is Winifred Black. Hashish will turn the mildest man into a bloodthirsty murderer. A man who smokes hashish runs amok with his bloody knife in one hand and his strangling cloth in the other, and he kills the hashish until the hashish has burnt out its deadly flames. 2 years later, the Surgeon General of the U.S., Cummings by name, writes the following. I like the modest, it is sometimes. It is sometimes alleged that the murderous frenzy of the melee characterized as running amok is the result of the habitual use of hashish. It is also said that the Mohammedan leaders opposing the Crusades utilized the services of individuals addicted to the use of hashish for secret murders. The frenzy produced by the drug led to these persons being called hashishin, hashashins, or hashishi, from which the word the modern word assassin. Okay. So what do I conclude out of all this? Well, for one thing, a desire to ban marijuana or ban cannabis comes in other countries besides the U.S., comes before the 1930s and comes from countries which don't have a hemp industry or don't have laws against the hemp industry or don't worry about a hemp industry. It seems to me that the concept of marijuana prohibition lies so far back and lies so into something basic about getting at strangers. The transition from opium leads to amok to marijuana leads to amok was so sudden, without opposition, that all I can say is that there's something religious, something psychological, something basic. People love to make stories about people in order to get at people and destroy them. It's not a very optimistic message to leave on, but I reached that conclusion. So, final pep talk. It's the 69th year of the war on marijuana. And somebody said it started in 1970. The Marijuana Tax Act is 1937. It's the 69th year of the war on marijuana. And in honor of 69, I suggest it's time to turn our usual policies, which is the same old missionary position, upside down. So just say no to the war on marijuana, no to the war on opium, and no to the war on drugs. Thank you.
That was historian Jerry Mandel at the 2006 Normal Conference, introduced there by Dale Gehringer. 2007 conference is coming up this week with Rick Steves and Tommy Chong. Make sure to get your registration if you'd like to attend this week. We have direct links at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Marsha Rosenbaum coming up next.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam. Experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal's Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Next up today in our conference audio is someone who will be at the 2007 conference later this week. It's Marsha Rosenbaum. Here she is, introduced at the 2006 Normal Conference.
Our next speaker is Marsha Rosenbaum. Marsha is a sociologist who did her doctoral work on heroin addiction, and she's really been in the trenches of harm reduction on heroin addiction. But I want to tell a story on Marsha. I know she's a sociologist because we were at lunch one day and we were talking about Montel Williams as a spokesman for medical cannabis. And we were kind of guessing about what sort of reaction Montel would have in the world out there. And as a sociologist, she said, well, let's just start asking people. So she hopped up from her chair and she went from table to table and she would ask them, when I say Montel, What is you hearing? Everybody knew Montel Williams. They were able to give that identification. And then she'd say, well, do you know that Montel has been in the news lately? And mostly what would happen is that the demographic of kind of 50-year-old white women knew that Montel had been in the news because he had been on the talk show circuit for his medical cannabis. And, or they knew that he'd been on the news. And then she would say, well, do you know why he's been on the news? And most of them didn't, But they would say, well, what's going on? And then Marcia would use the occasion to introduce the idea. And she said, well, he has multiple sclerosis and he smokes medical cannabis. And I will never forget the response from one of the women at one of the tables who, when Marcia said that, snorted and said, well, that'll make him forget he has MS. I was like, wow, that is the kind of hostility we're dealing with out there when we talk about this issue. And Marcia is very courageous to raise the question with people in a restaurant. She's also been very courageous, probably the person single most responsible for bringing the California Parent Teacher Association on board for sensible approaches to drug education in our schools. In the terms of rhetoric, she is a mom who cares about her kids. It makes her a very valuable messenger in bringing the message of harm reduction. So without further ado, Marcia Rosenbaum.
Now, remember, we were in Los Angeles for that lunch. We were not in San Francisco. The reaction would have been very different here, I think. So I want to share with you some of my experiences with rhetoric. You know, when Alan called me to ask me to be on this panel, I didn't even ask him what the panel was. I said, of course, you know, whatever you need. And then I looked at the title of the panel, Reefer Rhetoric and Retorts, Winning Ways to Frame the Marijuana Debate. And at that moment when I looked at it, I thought I had just gone on a trip with an actual trip to Turkey, actually, with my friend Donald Abrams. And he was talking about how his mother, not only does she talk about how the glass is half empty, but the glass is half empty and about to tip over. And that's how I've felt lately, this last month or so, with our issue. So I thought, winning ways, okay. So here's what I want to share with you. What it's like out there in conventional America to talk about the issue of marijuana. First, I have framed the issue as carefully as I can, particularly when it comes to teenagers and drug use and marijuana use, which is my focus. You know, basically, I don't think mainstream America really cares about what we say about marijuana until you start getting close to the kids. Now, when you get an audience with the kids, then they start getting nervous about what you're going to say. So I've been very, very careful. And, of course, I look like the straightest person that ever walked. Roger Goodman thinks he does, but I think I do. And so what I've tried to do is to influence the marijuana debate without talking about marijuana. My purposes were I wanted to educate parents, tell the truth, let them hear the truth. I wanted to advocate for, and still do, for honest, science-based drug education in schools, too. And my third purpose was to, and is, to undemonize marijuana. So here's what seems to have worked. Now, David introduced me and used the words harm reduction a couple of times. And, in fact, a decade ago, I had a booklet published, this one. It's called Kids, Drugs, and Drug Education, A Harm Reduction Approach. Bad title. Really bad title. First off, harm reduction has now become a lightning rod, so you can't really use it anyway. But harm reduction is sort of negative terms. Harm is negative. Reduction is negative. Kids, I don't say kids anymore if I can help it. Sometimes it comes out of my mouth because I think about my own children who I call my kids, and they're in their 20s, but kids doesn't work. What I found was, in terms of a title for what I was doing, instead of harm reduction, Safety first. Safety positive. Nobody objects to safety. Everyone likes safety. And first is first. And it's the tagline, a reality-based approach. Reality. I think when we talk about reality, what's really going on, that's a positive word. And teens. I use teens instead of kids now. So I also, much to the chagrin of Ethan Nadelman, our executive director, have tried to influence drug education without putting it in the context of broader drug policy reform or marijuana reform. And so when I do presentations and talks, it's safety first. It's a safety first project. And then down there in the little tagline is a project of the Drug Policy Alliance, which Ethan hates. But anyway, so that's what I've tried to do, is to put some distance. Also, another strategy that has heads nodding more than anything else, I think, is making sure that your definition of drugs is broad. When you start to talk about pharmaceutical drugs, when you start to talk about the commercials we see on television, on primetime TV, with this wonderful, very nice person asking you if you're worried all the time, and it's, of course, a commercial for Prozac or Paxil or one of those, this is a drug. It changes the way you think and feel and perceive things. And when people grasp, and they do quickly, that, hey, what we're talking about here, we're talking about marijuana and other illegal drugs, but really, there's no difference. A drug is a drug is a drug is a drug. And I think Americans now more than ever recognize that and are right there with you. You say, we're a drug-free America? Are you kidding? Of course, I always have a cup of Starbucks with me and say, this is my favorite drug. And they get that that's a drug, too. I also have found that, of course, we know this in our strategy with marijuana reform, is that when you equate marijuana policy with alcohol, people recognize that there are similarities between the two. I mean, they don't often know how much more dangerous alcohol is than marijuana, but I try to use the word prohibition whenever I can. Get people to see that this prohibition, marijuana prohibition, is the same as alcohol prohibition. Everybody knows that alcohol prohibition didn't work. That's a mantra. Oh, yeah, that didn't work. Okay, this is a prohibition, too. It's not working either. Another thing I've been using lately is that I keep hearing, I was talking to Keith about this last night and several other people, I'm so discouraged about the potency debate, which is not a debate out there in conventional America. They think, we believe the government's rhetoric that this marijuana is a million times more potent. All right, 30 times more potent, whatever. And so even people who are now in their 40s and 50s who used marijuana, conventional people, think that this is a qualitatively different drug. So we're not even arguing over marijuana anymore. They think it's a dangerous and scary kind of substance that they have no familiarity with. So I asked them, and this is usually in PTA groups, so they tell me this. Well, what about potency? And I say, well, how do you know that? How do you know that marijuana is more potent now? I say, well, I saw it on an ad. I say, what kind of ad do you think it was? Well, the government, the Office of National Drug Control Policy. I say, so that came out of the government. The government is the way that you know that this marijuana is a different substance. And they go, well, yeah. And I say, really? And you also believe that there actually were weapons of mass destruction now, do you? So they stop. Wait a minute. Ooh, the government. I've also found it useful in drug education, marijuana education, to draw parallels between this kind of education and sexuality education. I find that the word comprehensive education is much better even than abstinence plus kind of education, and that seems to be seems to work. Also, I agree with people who say, and I'm usually the first to say it actually, that it would be better if adolescents would abstain from experimentation with alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs, because I do believe that. So you can agree. We agree. Abstinence would be best. But then I insist whoever I'm talking to, whether it's Bill O'Reilly, who couldn't answer this one either. Okay. So we all agree abstinence would be best. But what if the kids refuse to be abstinent? What if they don't listen? They don't always listen. And I want to know, what is your fallback strategy if they don't just say no? What's the fallback strategy? What is your plan B? And, of course, they have no plan B because they're so invested in saying no, 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 that they don't have another set of admonitions for the kids. So they can't answer that one. And finally, I find that speaking from the heart has been really rewarding and useful for me. I use I a lot more than I ever did when I was an academic. And much to the chagrin of my children, I use them as examples all the time. And it has been, when I'm talking to audiences of parents who also have kids who, like my kids, didn't always do everything they told them to do when they told them to do it. These parents, mostly women in the PTA, get it. And that's how we got into the PTA. It's that their kids weren't perfect. They wanted a fallback strategy and they weren't finding it anywhere else. So those are some experiences. I just want to tell you though that, in terms of how the other side uses the rhetoric that works for us, they, 10 years ago, I don't think they really noticed us. I think that's why Proposition 215 passed in the form it passed in and by the margin that it passed at. They're watching us now. They are watching us now. They're probably in this room right now. They're probably and I'm not a paranoid person by nature. I'm really not. Some people think I'm too trusting, but I know they're there. I know you're there, is that they see what resonates for us, and then they take that rhetoric and they use it. I'll give you an example. Random student drug testing, which is the new push of the federal government, which is the scariest thing of all, I think. They're marching forward on this, and school districts and parents are lapping this stuff up. Let me tell you, if it weren't for our movement and us holding this thing back a little bit, providing some kind of rhetoric for opposing random student drug testing, I worry that they'd be testing all our kids, and the next thing in line after they test the kids is us for driver's licenses. It's a slippery slope, I think. But anyway, now when you look at their rhetoric on random student drug testing, it's not about punishment. No, 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 no. We want to help the kids. We want to provide them with a way to say no, because we know they all want to, and they're just, peer pressure is so strong. So they take our rhetoric about talking and relationships and parents and kids, and they twist it. But mostly what they do is they attack and they twist our language and they discredit. They use it to discredit us. I'll just give you a couple of examples, and I wish I had this, but I don't, because Clint Werner just provided me with the May issue of May 2006. This is National Geographic, okay? And sorry, you can't see this, but you can see maybe that this is a page, a green page with a marijuana leaf, okay? And the first thing you see is this word yes, and you're going, wait a minute, National Geographic here. But what it says is, if you're not telling them no, you're telling them yes. And this is the parents, the anti-drug. So this is the Office of National Drug Control, basically saying, you guys who are saying, well, just say K-N-O-W, you're not saying no, so you must be saying yes. So that's, they do that. Couple of other examples. The Scientologists, I'm so grateful to see that it was them this time, posted a thing on some website. You can't tell what they are. Somebody else had to tell me, who are these people? It said, it had a whole article about safety first, and it said, drug education or educating druggies. So you may remember the term druggies from the Supreme Court case. Also, in terms of things that were not a good idea for me, last year at this conference, we talked about this book, It's Just a Plant. And what happened was, it's a book for parents of young children who they're still getting read to, and they get caught smoking marijuana, and how do they tell their kids about what this thing really is? That's what this book is about. And the guy who is the artist and the author of it asked me if I would make a statement about it, which I love the book. And in a moment of being emboldened, I don't remember why I was so emboldened that particular week, I said, yes, I'm going to stand on principle. I will write an epilogue for your book. And it basically says, this is good drug education. That's all. Well, that's not what Mark Souter thought in Congress when he holds the thing up and criticizes DPA. And see, this is evidence. These people advocate marijuana use for children. So that's how things get. And Calvina Fay, our old friend, used it too. So that was a bad idea. It's also was a bad idea, I must tell you, that I got a call from a person who told me that his organization was, his name is Cliff Kincaid, and it's a very inaccurate title for the organization that he heads up, which is called Accuracy in Media. But what do I know? Calls me up and he says, were you on a panel in which you said that it would be useful for controlled drug users to be part of drug education? And I thought, And so I said, where is it? And he told me where it was. And I went and looked at the video. And the only way that I knew that the thing was at least a decade ago, if not more, was that my hair hasn't been that short in 10 years. So I went, uh-oh. And so indeed it was. And but in another moment of feeling confident and emboldened, I had just gone to the National PTA Convention and ran a workshop there, and it was so wonderful. It just went really, really well. And so I said to him, well, I think that was me. Yeah. I said, of course, my thinking has evolved. Hasn't everybody's in 10 years? I probably wouldn't say the same thing. But I just want you to know that our message is resonating, I say to him. Our message of safety first is resonating. As an example, I just spoke at the National PTA Convention, and it went great. Well, bad idea, another bad idea. He then starts a letter-writing campaign to the PTA, to the National PTA, discrediting, saying, do you know that you had at your conference a drug legalizer And so now starts a letter writing campaign to the national PTA. California State PTA didn't care. They say, oh, we don't listen to them. So they're, you know, that's because that's California. Anyway, those are some experiences. Remember, I know that they're watching. I only take heart. So be careful, careful, careful about what you say. It's going to get recorded. The next thing you know, you were on a panel with Ed Rosenthal. And what does that mean? But I think that it's also evidence that they're scared. They're watching because they're scared, and they know that we're winning. So I guess we must be winning. Thank you.
That was Marsha Rosenbaum at the 2006 Normal Conference. More information about Marsha and Jerry Mandel, the speaker we heard earlier, are available on our website at normalaudiostash.com. If you have a chance, join us this week in Los Angeles for the Normal Annual Conference. It starts up on Friday, October 13th, and goes through Saturday the 14th with the Stony Awards on Saturday night. PBS travel host Rick Steves and comedian Tommy Chong, along with the most influential voices, activists, doctors, and attorneys in the marijuana law reform movement, will be speaking at the 2007 conference. Join us there in L.A. Again, we have links on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.